Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 31st, 2000. In the Creekside room this morning is Pam Holsinger Fuchs. Today's session number is HFP 2001, and it's titled A White Ally in a Multicultural World. Let's listen in.
Holsinger Fuchs, and I work at the University of Minnesota in Crookston, and I've had a number of different occupations in my past, but one of the things that I call myself a white ally in a multicultural world, and the reason I do that is that I have a real passion for what I see as the needs of some of our brothers and sisters of other backgrounds. I grew up in Midland, Michigan, and Midland, Michigan was the headquarters of Dow Chemical. And Herbert Henry Dow had written a book and actually said in his book that he would never hire a black person to work for his company. And he didn't until he was forced to do so. So I grew up in a very white community. I had one Japanese-American young girl that lived in my community, and that was it. So I certainly don't come from a background. But when I went to graduate school, I ended up working as the advisor for our Black Caucus at Michigan State University. I was the only white person in meetings of, you know, 300 or 400 or 500 people. And I guess for me, it really opened my eyes up and made me realize what it was like to be a minority in a majority culture or in a majority group. And I've had lots of other experiences along the way. I'm not an expert, but I really do feel very strongly about this. I also have a couple of things I just wanted to say. One was about, I think there's a wonderful organization that's called Teaching Tolerance. And they have great materials, and I'll share some of those things with you later. I don't personally like that title at all, because I think that to tolerate somebody is to just sort of put up with them. And so I don't like the idea of teaching someone to be tolerant. You know, I have my children tolerate certain vegetables because, you know, they should eat them because they're good for them, but they don't like them. So anyway, those are some of the things. And I guess I'm going to also start with sharing a story with you. This will be very interactive, so you'll have a chance to get to know each other better. And we'll do a series of exercises that I hope are things that maybe you can take back to do with children or congregations or workplaces. They're pretty simple, and they'll lead us into a progression of a little bit deeper sharing. And I'll ask all of you to share your wisdom and experiences, too. The story I want to share with you is a story about elephants. And I personally like the circus. My husband doesn't, so I take the children to the circus. But I always wondered about the elephants there, and they're huge. I mean, elephants are mammoth creatures. And elephants are trained, and some of you might know this, when they're little elephants, they have a big log chain that goes around their foot. And it's pounded into the ground, and the elephant can't move. Well, then as an elephant gets bigger and bigger, they can move. And at any point, they could pull that log chain up and they could go wherever they wanted to. But they don't think they can because they've been conditioned from the time that they were little to believe that that log chain is keeping them to this place. And I kind of use that as an example of, I think that for myself, I was taught things as a child that weren't necessarily true. But I think that because, you know, I was taught them by people that I respected, or, you know, I saw them in movies, you know, the stereotypes and prejudices, that sometimes I believed them. And it took me a long time to realize that I don't have to stand here in this spot with this log chain, that I can move over here, and then I can, suddenly the world becomes much bigger and much richer. So I'll start with that. What I'd like you to do now would be to find a person in this room that you don't know, and I want you to go and introduce yourself to them, and I want you to share with them about your name. And I'll explain why we're doing this later. My name is Pamela Jo Holsinger Fuchs, and I'll just share with you one part of my name, and this is kind of an example, and hopefully there's something about your name. It was your grandfather's, or it's an ethnic name, or if you can't think of anything, then come up with, you know, if you know why your parents named you that. My middle name is Jo, and it is that because my mother was a single mom in 1959. Which is in a time when it was very appropriate to be unwed. And one of the few people that stood up with her and walked with her in that journey was her cousin Joe. And they're great friends to this day. And she named me Pamela Joe in honor of him and the fact that he was willing to walk with her in a very tough time for her. So that's a little bit about my name. So I'd like you to give us one other person that you don't know, and if you would just share with them for a few minutes. Welcome, Jenna. Come on in and join us. You can sit up here. That paper pencil. bit about each other's names? Yes? Did you find out interesting things? Does anybody want to share one thing? Anybody? Oh, you're so quiet now. Come on.
Well, the man that I spoke with, his mother intervened and saved him from a name that sounds like could have had a lot of
Irish in it. Michael Patrick. Michael Francis Patrick Aloysius was what my dad wanted.
So sometimes as much as what you are is what you were not named.
Right.
You
know? The reason I do the exercise is because I think our names are very important. I mean, they are part of who we are. And I think that it's really important that we call people by what they wish to be called. And I work with a lot of international students. And I use the example, a lot of times I think I'll own it to myself. Sometimes I would prefer to call someone a nickname because it's easier for me to pronounce than it is to pronounce a name that is hard because it's not familiar to me. But I also think about, there's a young man here whose name is Kenichi, and he's one of the Japanese students that's here in the village. And he was introducing himself to my husband, and my husband couldn't get his name, and he said, just call me Ken. You know, and I thought, well, no, would you prefer to be called Ken? And he said, well, no, but it's easier. And I thought, no, I will learn how to say Kenichi, which isn't that much harder, but because it is his name. And I think to be in a foreign country in a different place and then suddenly to lose your name and your kind of your identity too is also an important thing. So that's just an example. I mean, own people. And then I think it's kind of interesting to find out how were we named, or why were we not named something? You know, what is it that we've chosen? And my daughter's names I chose very carefully, and they all have a history behind that because I felt like it was a gift that I was giving my children, you know, something that they would be known in the world for. So. The next thing I want you to do is find another person that you don't know, and I only want you to introduce yourself to them, tell them your name, maybe tell them where you live when you're not at Holden and how long you'll be staying at Holden. Okay, those are the only things I want you to talk to them about, and then you need to have your piece of paper and pencil with you. Okay? Another way for you to get to know someone. And then you'll want to sit near them because then I'll have you talk or do some little sharing after that. So this is a great way to get to know people. Those of you who are old enough will have all kinds of people. Piece of paper. Does everyone have their paper and their pencil or writing utensils? Okay. All right, I want you, now hopefully you didn't disobey my orders. So, anyway. Okay, I want you to write down, just by looking at this person or having met them, I want you to tell me, what does this person do for an occupation? Did you cheat?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, just look at them, kind of make it, you know, from what you know about where they live and what their name is and how long they're staying at the village. I don't know, that's what you know about them. So what does this person do for an occupation?
Either here at Holden or cooking
through. All right.
Okay. Does everyone have that? Okay. What kind of car does this person drive? You write it down. Just write it for now. Don't share with the other person. Just write it down. Okay? What kind of car does this person drive? Year, you know, model, make, color. Okay. Is this person artistic, do you think, or craftsy, like working with their hands, doing woodworking maybe, or whittling, knitting, crocheting? Painting.
So something beyond just handy. Hobby, yeah, like a specific hobby.
Yeah, do you think that person
crafts?
Yeah, do you think they're kind of a creative person or? Okay, are they athletic? Is this person fairly athletic? Do they like, you know, working out or walking or running or swimming or? Okay, what is this person's dream vacation?
Man, I don't know.
Y'all have one unfair, you know, one unfair advantage already. Y'all came to Holden, right? So you know something about this person and that they chose to come to this mountain village. You know where they live. Okay, is everyone done? No. Some of you are more contemplative than others. Contemplative. Good thinking. Okay, now what I'd like you to do is to share with each other first what your assumptions were about the other person. Okay, and then I want that. Then I want you each to share. Like, for example, are they athletic? Okay, if you were to say that about me, how many of you would say I'm athletic? Anybody want to say I'm athletic?
Active.
Okay, I'm not at all. But why would you think that?
Because you're young.
Because I'm young. I'm not over. Wait, my father, my biological father, is big. Big. He's like big. I mean, he's like a big man. I don't know how much he weighs. Probably a lot, like 250, 300 pounds. I mean, he's big. He swims every day. And you'd look at him and you'd think the guy was like not athletic. So sometimes we make assumptions about people, you know, based on we kind of look at them. So anyway, share with each other just briefly and then we'll move on.
Wait for you to get to know each other.
Okay. You guys were having so much fun. Isn't this a great session to get to know these people? Why did I do that particular exercise? Anybody have any idea?
To help us see where our assumptions are either correct or off. Mm-hmm. And more likely than not, we would be off at least once, and maybe the whole time.
Right. Was anybody right on? Did anybody have their person packed pretty well? You did. Okay.
Four and a half?
That's amazing.
Is it somebody that you have a lot in common? I mean, are you actually similar in identity at all, or was it just really different?
Oh, we're both school teachers.
We could tell each other.
You could always pick a school teacher.
Can you always pick a school teacher out of a crowd, really? How can you do that?
Careful. You ask tough questions.
Good looks are one thing.
Right, yeah. Athletic, yeah.
Personable. Responsible.
When you associate with school teachers for your whole life, there is an air about a school teacher.
Okay, sort of a honing in. Honing the.
And my wife will say the same thing. You know, we'll be traveling and school teacher. And so then now you got to get around and, you know, ask the right questions and, you know.
Sure enough.
But I called her a nurse and she's a teacher.
She's a kindly teacher.
So often it's the one organizing. Yeah. Telling everybody else, giving directions.
Right.
Whether they know them or not.
Right. Yeah. The reason, I think this is a fun exercise to do if you're getting a group together for the first time, because I think we all do make assumptions about people, and we always do it through our own lenses too. And I'll share an example. When I lived in Washington, we had a rock group come in for this like contemporary worship service, and some older members of our congregation came. And during the whole thing, I just thought, oh, I'm sure they just are like appalled at this. You know, it's not at all liturgical. And I felt, you know, so bad. So afterwards I went up and I said, you know, I hope this was okay for you. And they're like, this was great. We love music. Back in the 20s, we used to go dancing and this is so great. And I was just like, oh, well that, you know, but I had this assumption that because they were older people, that they were going to be sitting there just totally out of their homeostasis, out of their element, thinking this was horrible. And they loved it. So, you know, I mean, I do that all the time. I think we all do that. And we make assumptions. We judge people. We look at the way they dress, you know, and I think we also do that with members of other groups. We, you know, we see an African-American person, a black person, a Native American. I mean, we have ideas in our minds about what those people are like, you know, and some of it is based on, you know, some of our own information. Some of it's based on TV shows and movies and things that we were taught that aren't accurate. So, anyway, assumptions. We're going to go on, and you need a piece of paper again, but this is something you're just going to do by yourself. And the teacher should do really well with this, so we'll see. But I want you to, the pressure's now on. I want you to draw a picture of the world. if we cut the globe open and we laid it out, I want you to draw the world for me.
Like a map of the entire world?
A map of the entire world. And if possible, label, continents, countries.
This is where the non-artistic people like to
share. Oh, you won't share it with anyone, so don't worry about how it looks at all. And try to label as many continents and countries as you can. And then also I'd like you to put on there, maybe to mark with a little star, places that you've lived. And then with a smiley face, put on there places where your ancestors came from. My grandfather was from Russia. My grandmother was from... my great-grandmother was from Germany and Ireland and Scotland, so...
I give up. I mean, I've learned already. I can't draw any of the shapes except for South America.
Okay, we'll talk about that. We'll try. Do we like little blobs? Antarctica.
No, I know.
And Pole, Africa, Australia, New Zealand.
I know Europe. Yeah.
Asia and Europe is just a big mess for me. I am. You notice that I'm doing this.
How many of you are going like this? Drawing kind of really close.
Ran out of paper.
Yeah. You ran out of. Do you need some more?
No. Oh my God, this is a lot.
I won't make you go on with that one very long. I think that I do this, well, Jeanette, what does that say to you?
Well, I don't know, that I'm just ethnocentric, see? But I'm actually familiar with the world when I travel some. And I'm aware of it, but when it really comes right down to it, I'm much more, I started in the center with my own country.
How many of you put the United States right in the middle of your map?
We have a map that happened at home, we live here, that shows it was done to balance and true measurement. And we saw that the traditional map makes Mexico this little thing and Alaska this huge thing. And actually, it's the reverse. And so when I was doing this, I was influenced by that map that traditionally the northern countries are huge, southern countries are smaller.
So. Right.
But I think we grew up in a geography class and everything. America and Europe is huge, but when you actually measure
the land masses,
the whole thing is to. In fact, there's a map floating around where instead of having the north on top and the south on bottom, it's reversed. And that's an eye opener, because we always like to be on top.
Right.
That's one way of looking at the world.
That's right. Yeah. Anybody else want to share anything that you felt when you were doing that?
And I can never remember how big Australia really is. Mm-hmm. I know it's this huge country, it's really the size of North America. And so I was trying to draw it real nice and big, but then it didn't look right. It's funny, because as a child when you're taught geography, you thought of Australia as kind of this little country down, somewhere, but it's as big as ours. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when you were a child and if you dug, what did your parents tell you? If you keep digging, you're going to dig to
China.
So what do you think Chinese parents tell their children?
You're
going to dig to the American. We were talking. I like this exercise if you have a group, especially if you have a group of people that are from different places, because it's sometimes really interesting to then have people share, where have they lived, so you kind of get an idea where people's, background understanding, and then to help them a little bit realize, too, especially sometimes for younger people, they don't have necessarily a real sense of what their ethnic background is, and, there's the whole thing about, America was the big melting pot. Well, and then we moved from America is the salad bowl, and we have individual differences and we recognize those and stuff. And I think it helps sometimes to have people recognize that, unless you're a Native American, Columbus didn't discover America. I mean, there were people here. Columbus stole America and claimed it. But I think it helps, that's my own bias, but anyway. I think that's good to kind of do it. So another exercise that maybe you might want to take back and use with people and kind of a fun one. If we had more time, I'd have people kind of go around. Does anyone want to share anything about their map anymore, about like where you're, no? How the school teachers do?
We did a Mercator map, which is kind of a world sliced up so you get their proportions.
You did, I did.
Okay. Does everyone still have enough paper? Do people need some more paper? Anybody need additional paper? I'm going to ask you to do another exercise. I think the other thing is that, you know, they talk about the world getting smaller all the time, and the university that I happen to work at is the laptop college. We're the original ThinkPad University. We're wired with everything. I mean, we have students that are on the internet continually, and with that comes a great deal of, you know, freedom and opportunity for them to learn a lot, but, you know, unfortunately most of them choose not to do that. They're in chat rooms and things like that. But, you know, I think our world does get smaller, and hopefully at some point that'll allow us to be more aware of, you know, the needs of our the rest of the world. I don't know if any of you were here to see the movie Affluenza. No. It's a wonderful movie, and it really talked about, you know, the global economy and how we impact each other so much. And anyway, let me think of that. What I'm going to have you do now is something called Name 5. Has anyone ever done this before? Okay. And it might take a little while. So I'm actually probably going to let you get off easy, and the exercise is actually called Name 5, but I'll have you do Name 2, because for time's sake. And I want you to name 2 famous people. Just write down 2 famous people.
Living or dead.
Yeah. Okay. I want you to name 2 famous African Americans. I should make you do 5 because it's much harder when you have to do that. 2 famous Hispanic or Latinos. Famous disabled or other abled persons. Two Asian Americans, famous Asian Americans.
Did you say Asian Americans? Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you want all these people to be like Hispanic Americans, well, Americans from that, or do you mean it's okay to?
It's okay to do.
From that are okay.
Does it count if we write down what we do because they can't remember their names?
I'm sure we can do that.
Okay.
Then they all have to be famous.
Mm-hmm. 2 famous women. Famous Native Americans.
Oh, I'm sorry, what's the last one?
Native American. And 2 famous gay or lesbians.
Thank you.
How did everyone do?
Not too well in the Native Americans.
Try to do 5 in each area. It's really hard. Mm. And like you were saying, can you write down what they do, but not who they are? And I had that too. For Asian American, I had, that ice skater. What's that girl's name? Michelle Kwan. But I couldn't think of it, you know. It's like, what? Yeah.
So. The mirror pitcher. What's his name?
Gary Locke is the governor of Washington. Yeah, there are actually 2 of his campaign staff members that were here yesterday. So. Former students that I know, so kind of funny when they're these jobs, you know, real jobs in the world. Okay, what about African Americans? What did people come up with?
Malcolm X and Louis Farrakhan.
Martin
Luther
King. Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu.
Mm-hmm.
They're Americans.
Oh, they're not Americans. Forget it.
Joe Biggins,
you need
to go. Yeah. Booker T. Washington.
Well, in that one, the sports, the athletic.
Oh,
yeah.
So many
famous African American athletes. Mm-hmm.
Did anybody do sports?
I did.
I didn't even cross my mind. I mean, you said famous. That makes so famous, but I guess.
Colin Powell and Bill Cosby.
Yeah, I wrote.
Oprah, E.B. Cummings, yeah. Will Smith, Shirley Chisholm. Those are the first ones.
Yes.
Rosa Parks, Thurgood Marshall, Jesse Owens, Olympic track star, Maya Angelou. It's kind of
Angelou.
How about Hispanic, Latino?
Cesar Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
Cesar Romero.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Did you say that?
Cesar Chavez.
Oh, okay. I'll call it Allende.
Santa Ana?
Santa Ana.
Desi Arnaz.
Yeah, I had Desi Arnaz. And Ricky Ricardo.
Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ricky Martin. Oh.
I wrote Feliciano. Did he?
Jose Feliciano.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Hispanic Latino. I mean, there's so many ethnic groups too. I mean, it's like, you know, Mexican, yes. Hispanic Latino. So, how about people with disabilities or differently able?
FDR. Yeah. George Wallace.
Helen Keller.
Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
I put Ray Charles
down. Ray Charles.
And isn't there a David Hawkins? I think that's
done. He's the great black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm thinking of white. He means
the
same.
Oh, no, he's white, but yeah. He's the black
hole theory.
Yes.
The
physicist. Yeah. There's also, when I was looking for some research to do on this, there's a wonderful, and I can pass this around, book called Welcoming People with Disabilities, A Challenge for the Faith Community. And they had a number of this is actually a survey that you can do within your congregation. You know, I don't know how many. I have a close personal friend of mine, lost both of his legs to cancer. He's Ralph Jacobson, he's a pastor, and he's in a wheelchair. And the congregation he went to did this whole big thing with, you know, handicap ramps and an elevator and stuff, you know, after he came there, because he kind of brought it to their attention. But I'll pass it around. There's, and just with Helen Keller, someone mentioned that there's 17.7 million hearing impaired people in this country. So it is a huge thing, and I think we need to look at. There's a gentleman here this week that is in a chair, and I had my a cousin came up here when we lived here, and she was in a chair, and she found it, and her parents found it extremely difficult to be here with her, because we kind of say, oh, you know, things are accessible, but you know, when you're going up a hill like this and you're pushing someone and it's as hot as it is, you know, and you're going over bumps, you know, well, yeah, it's accessible, but it's not easily accessible. So, there's also a neat community called the L'Arche community. Are people familiar with that? Jean Vanier started in France, and there's L'Arche communities all over the country now, and they're for developmentally disabled people. So, and it's more, so not, you know, necessarily physically challenged, but mentally challenged. And Holden does a pretty good job about trying to invite people into the community. The young man that came in and left again, he's autistic and has been on staff here for 2 years. And I think Holden tries to make a space for people that, you know, maybe have different needs. How about Asian Americans? That was the absolute hardest for me.
Is it Dan Hanaway? And then he was just honored. He's the senator from Hawaii.
Yes,
he's the one that I thought of and I couldn't remember.
Yeah, me too. I could put Senator Hawaii. That's as far as I could get.
Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. Connie Chung. Jackie Chang. And some of you, how many of you are from Washington? Have you all been to the state fair here?
Which one?
Yeah, you mean just at some point?
The Washington State Fair near
Evergreen State Fair.
And most of you, I don't know if you've been to the horse stables there, but most of you probably know this, but I did a lot of work with the Amerasian Resettlement Program when the children of Vietnamese servicemen came to this country. And there's a wonderful Asian museum down in the International District, if any of you haven't been there, I'd encourage you to go. But the horse barns and horse stables at the Washington State Fair were used as a Japanese internment camp in 1942. And there were 112,000 people that were put in, you know, internment camps all over the country because of the fear that they were smuggling information back to Japan and stuff. And some of you are probably much more familiar with that whole era than I am. I'm only familiar about it from my work with Asian people. And there's also, and I could not remember, but of course there were many, many, many Chinese that came to this country to help build the railroad, and they were such hardworking people. And at this museum, I can't remember, but it's like they have this sign up that says, I think there were over 70 different words for death in the Chinese language, because their lives were so perilous in putting down this railroad that, I mean, half of them probably never lived. But it was a chance for them to earn money and to go back to their own countries. And
so. I just read about the history of in Tacoma where they, I forgot what year it was, but they literally drove the Chinese out and burned their houses. Yes. And then that started to be known as you know, the way Tacoma dealt with the Chinese, it was this phrase was coined, and then it was used around the country, like, well, Tacoma on them or something. You know, it was just really hideous. What's that?
Seattle also did that.
Yeah, I think, yeah, they did. I think that I was very surprised to find out I think it actually happened in Tacoma first, and that's how it was coined, but they're erecting a memorial to those people now finally on the Tacoma waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish I could remember the term, but for some reason it was just even more horrifying that the Queen Anne Crum was the name attached to this method of dealing with the Chinese.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to pass this around. This is by that group I said, Teaching Tolerance, and those of you that are teachers, do you use this at all in your... They give free information. They'll send a whole free kit. There's a whole one they do on like the civil rights movement and stuff that's excellent. But they'll send a free one to anybody within the school. But there's some wonderful, it's called Us and Them. There's some wonderful stories, well, not wonderful, but very eye-opening stories about different issues. And one of them is removing the Chinese from somewhere in Wyoming. And they basically came in and killed many of them and burned their homes and then forced them out. So, how about Native Americans? And there's many, many tribes. So to lump all the Native Americans and say Native Americans, I work with Lakota and Mille Lacs Band are the two that are closest to. I need to share this with you too. I was telling someone that I was going to do this session and they go, a multicultural ally, or no, they said a white ally in a multicultural world. You live in northern Minnesota. Isn't that kind of an oxymoron? And I said, well, actually we're near two large Indian reservations. And I said, and because the town I live in is sugar beets and very highly agricultural, there's many, many, many Hispanic families that have moved into our community. And we actually run an underground out of our town for people, a lot from Central America that are persecuted that go to Canada. And so, you know, I don't know, it was kind of, I thought,
Well, that was an assumption.
It was an assumption that that person made, too, so.
Sitting Bull and Chief Joseph for.
Okay. Anyone else?
Jay Silver Heels.
Sam.
Tonto.
Jim Thorpe.
Joe Dela Cruz was a big shot Indian in this state.
I put down Russell Means, who's an activist, Leonard Peltier, who's still in prison as far as I know. And then I wrote down that Chief Sale Sacagawea Pocahontas. So I thought it was interesting when I was doing it that a lot of the people, you know, were dead. I mean, do I not know? I mean, are there not Native Americans that are in prominent leadership positions? Well, you know, there aren't that many, so what does that say? There was a story to us, you know, when I was doing this, there was a teacher who was teaching and trying to teach math to these children, and she said, okay, if you have 8 birds up in a tree and you shoot one, how many will you have left? And all the little kids are raising their hand. They're like, one, you know, so you have 7. And this one little boy said, no. A little Native American boy said, you won't have any. You'll have 0. And she's like, no. 8 minus 1 is 7. He said, well, if you shoot them, they all fly away. You know, so I think we have to look at our, again, it's like, what is, you know, what is that boy's understanding? And he's out there shooting birds and they fly. Okay, there's 1.8 million Native Americans in this country, and many of them are still on reservations, and I think we're aware of those problems there. How about women, famous women?
Eleanor Roosevelt. Sally
Wright.
Jackie Marion Wright Edelman is one of my heroes. She's works with the Children's Defense Fund. Sally Field is my favorite woman actress. So. Florence Nightingale and Madame Curie. I always had this Curie complex growing up. I thought I would do great things. How about famous gay or lesbian people?
Great.
Okay. Public television made that pretty well known.
Greg Louganis.
I put down Eleanor Roosevelt, Rock Hudson, Walt Whitman, Jane Addams, Elaine Noble, who's in the Massachusetts House of Republican Representatives. How many of you had, when you put down your famous people, how many of you put down men? And how many of you put down white men?
The very first
question.
When I asked for, you know, name your 2 famous people.
We knew that question was coming, so we purposely divided.
You did. You're catching on. You're a school teacher. I find that when I've done this before, that's pretty common, that you think of famous people and you put down. I, of course, put Mother Teresa in a while. But I think that that's interesting, too. And if you didn't do that, then that's interesting, too, why you didn't. Did you do it because you knew that you were in this session, you're supposed to be more sensitive to this, and you should change it and make sure you have a man and a woman, or, you know, some whatever, so I don't know. I think part of it's about areas, you know, for me it's about areas that you do know and areas that you don't know, and then why is it that there are, in some situations, so few, you know, why is it that the Native Americans we know about, for me anyway, are mostly dead people, and the other thing I want to move into now is I handed out little slips of paper to you, and have a good dish to you. Oh, okay. This is on something called white privilege. And the woman that wrote this is Peg McIntosh, and she's from the University of Delaware. And she says, I have chosen those conditions that I think, in my case, attach somewhat more to skin color privilege than to class, religion, ethnic status, or geographical location, though these other privileging factors are intertwined. So, how many of you have done this exercise before, or seen this list of white privileges?
I've done an exercise called leveling the playing field. Okay. Have you ever done that, where you start out in a line, and these items are used, these criteria, and if you line everybody up across the room, and if you can answer, you know, yes to the question, you get to take a step forward, and if you have to answer no to the question, you take a step back. Is very interesting to see how the room ends up. It's a very powerful
one.
But it uses these
the same criteria.
Yeah.
No, I didn't get one of those.
Oh.
Here's
an extra one.
Oh, okay.
I do have some extras, but I was going to hand this around too. This is a book that are amazing called Rethinking Columbus, and it has some really good articles and exercises too about how to reteach or teach our children. things about our history, so I'll pass it on as well. And also this, again, lesbian history in the United States, a timeline, which I thought was very fascinating. Especially there's one thing that Eleanor Roosevelt was, maybe I'm wrong on this. I was thinking she was a lesbian woman and was, of course, not very well known. And I was thinking that her husband had made some pretty wide policy statements regarding homosexuality, but it's actually Dwight Eisenhower, so I was wrong there. I'll pass this around. I thought this was interesting, too. Okay. Does anyone want to just randomly start and read the statements?
I can be pretty sure that my children's teachers and employers will tolerate them if they fit school and workplace norms. My chief worries about them do not concern other attitudes towards their race.
I can be reasonably sure that my neighbors in such a location will be neutral or pleasant to me.
When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is.
I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time.
I can be sure that my children will be given curriculum materials that testify to the existence of their race.
I can turn on the television or look at the front page of the newspaper and see people of my race widely and positively represented.
I can go to a bookshop and count on finding the writing of my race represented, in a supermarket and find the staple foods that fit with my cultural traditions, into a hairdresser's shop and find someone who can deal with my hair.
Whether I use checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance that I am financially reliable.
If I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing housing in an area which I can afford and in which I would want to live.
I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having my coworkers on the job suspect that I got it because of my race.
I can go shopping alone most of the time, fairly well assured that I will not be followed or harassed by store detectives.
I can choose blemish cover or bandages in, quote, flesh color and have them more or less match my skin.
I could arrange to protect our young children most of the time from people who might not like them.
I can be sure that if I needed legal or medical help, my race will not work against me.
I can swear, dress in secondhand clothes, or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race.
I can drive a Cadillac without people thinking I'm a drug dealer.
I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group.
If a traffic cop pulls me over or if the IRS edits my tax returns, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race.
I can choose public accommodations without fearing that people of my race cannot get in or will be mistreated in the places I have chosen.
I can avoid spending time with people whom I was trained to mistrust and who've learned to mistrust me or my kind.
I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race.
I can be reasonably sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will be facing a person of my race.
I don't know when I first heard those many years ago, but that is what white privilege is. And I guess that's why I think I have an opportunity or a responsibility to speak out. Because there wasn't anything I did. I was born. I was was born white, and because of that I have a lot of things that we just heard about that other people don't have because they weren't born white. And I just wanted to read from to Matthew 25, 45. Then he will answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And I think we're all familiar with that. When did I see you hungry? When did I see you, you know, cold and I didn't help you? So I offer that to you. And I guess I'd like to have you give me some feedback about what you thought of those things.
How much of this is attributed to social class as well?
I'm
thinking of the kids in the store, white kids with the hats backwards, the baggy pants and things. They're going to be watched real carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Where the kid that may come in with a suit and tie, they wouldn't think twice about it.
When I was doing the exercise, I was just talking about the leveling the playing field, where it's not effective in a group of white folks like this, but if you have a multicultural group, it's very effective to see where you end up, and it kind of addresses that issue. And I did it with, I serve on the board for the Division of Higher Education and Schools at the ELCA office in Chicago, and all of the board members for all the divisions at ELCA were required to do a two-day multicultural training, and this was one of the exercises that we did. And so we had a rather diverse ethnic and socioeconomic background group, and it's real interesting to see where folks end up, because it isn't like, you know, all the black folks were in one line at the back and all the white folks were in one line in front. I mean, people were scattered throughout, and I found myself, because I grew up very poor, in a and my son is black, so some of the issues that where it talks about my children will have this privilege, yada yada, you know, obviously that didn't apply to me. So I found myself kind of right dead middle. I mean, I went up a little, I went back a little, but I basically ended up in the middle. The black men were obviously the furthest back. The black women were, in front of them, as were some other, Chinese Americans, a few other immigrants from other countries that had come. And the white men tended to be the farthest forward, and then white women and some white men scattered in front of that. And I think the socioeconomic issues certainly are, but it's very dramatic, and it is. The interesting thing for me, it ended up exactly as I thought it would end up, and there was no surprise in this whatsoever to me. I knew where we were all going to end up. And what was surprising to me were the number of folks who were up at the front of the room, particularly the white men at the front. I mean, some of these people were in tears. It was such an emotional, powerful experience for them, and they had no idea. And I had to respect that, yet inside I was thinking, where have they been living? I mean, how could they not know this is where you were going to end up? But they didn't know they were privileged. I mean, and these are well-educated people serving on a variety of boards at ELCA who just had no idea that this is the real world. And so I really commend you for doing classes like this, because I think that there's a lot of folks that just don't know.
And I think the difference with that, and I think that there are, and I think if you talk, you can talk about ageism and sexism and all kinds of things too, that there'd be a lot of young people that would say, oh, I hate it, you know, they're always following me around. But if it's a white young person, they also make a choice about how they're dressing, and they could choose to dress differently, and they wouldn't have that reaction. Whereas if there's a black person or a Native American person, you know, they can dress very nicely. And I have a close friend of mine who is African-American who will never, I mean, he always dresses impeccably for that very reason, because, I mean, it's at least some safeguard for him that he'll be treated kind of equally almost, maybe, as a white person.
The 15 or 20 times I was stopped by police growing up in New York City and the other places I've been, between the ages of like 15 and 30, I always knew I had an edge because I was white. I always knew it. And recently I was participating in something where they talked about this, and there was a member there who had a white woman who said, well, I don't understand any of this. And it made me think how we can criticize, and this may take a stretch, but it'll connect. We can criticize the people in Nazi Germany, and we can criticize the whites in South Africa, and we can say, how did they not know the impact of the national policy? But I would suggest to you that there's a group of white Americans who do not realize the impact of that privilege. Mm-hmm. And he was a woman saying, I don't understand any of this.
Mm-hmm. You could have been a plant. But we did not talk about this. There's this incredible book called Dismantling Racism, The Continuing Challenge to White America, and it's written for us. It's written for us white folks to read. And I read it, and I was just like, and it was about Germany. Okay, the guy wrote it. In Germany, more than 30 years ago, I discovered, he talks about socializing anesthesia, and that we kind of layer ourselves in anesthetize ourselves. Okay, and he says, accompanied by layers of insulation, worse to isolate us from reality. In 1960, I was a graduate student at a German university. There, my consciousness was first awakened to the reality of racism in America. Before and during World War II, the National Socialists, or Nazis, had carried out the extermination of more than 6 million Jews. After the facts of this Holocaust became known, the majority of Germans insisted that they didn't know it was happening. In response to those denials, the entire world asked incredulously, how can it be that you did not know? I asked the same question to my German acquaintances and friends. With arrogance and self-righteousness, I challenged the assertion that they did not know about the persecution of the Jews that was happening before their very eyes. Then toward the end of my studies, I participated in a seminar at the German Evangelical Academy on the subject race relations around the world. There I was introduced to the reality of race relations in the United States, described in graphic, historical, and contemporary detail. It was the time of the civil rights movement with the push to desegregate schools and public accommodations in the South, causing major upheaval such as the events at Little Rock, Arkansas. I was embarrassed to admit to my German colleagues that I knew virtually nothing about current racial realities in America. Most shocking, however, was an estimate by one of the speakers that the number of people of color who had been killed by white people in America since the time of Columbus was approximately 6 million, the same number as that of Jews who had been killed in the Holocaust. And I heard myself say the same words as the Germans, I didn't know. And indeed, it had not been hidden from me, and I was honestly not aware but at least on a conscious level, I had found the answer to why the Germans could say we didn't know what was happening. So.
And yet, in the rest of the world, if we were in Istanbul or Hong Kong, if you read those questions, all the white people would be way back here, and the Asians would be over here, or the, you know. The problem is that you're talking about America.
Right.
You know, which touts itself to be a melting pot, right. Which it isn't, of course not, it's multicultural. Mm-hmm. But in the rest of the world, you'd be looked at, well, you're very strange. Mm-hmm. Of course you keep those people down. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a discussion that wouldn't even be entertained in most of the rest of the world. When I was growing up, but I spent a good deal of time in Hawaii, that's one of the most race-conscious places I've ever been. Mm-hmm. Where everybody knows what you are by just looking at you, and treat you that way. You know, if you're not Asian, they're going to check your ID because you know that's, you're not part of my family, or if you're not Portuguese. So it's an interesting discussion, but it really only applies to this country, or in some parts of Europe, because in Africa. You know, you'll be treated downward if you're not black. Or actually, if you're not part of the right tribe. It's not that if you're black, it's not your skin color, it's your tribe there.
Depending on where in Africa you live.
Right. Well, I'm talking about the majority of Africa.
Right.
Because Africa is a huge place. And it's not just black. Yeah, in great fields of Africa, you'll be, unless you're Muslim. Or, just like, you know, in Rwanda, you know, if you were Tutsi instead of Hutu, mm-hmm. you know, 12 million of you were killed. 12 million.
Well, you know, not six, 12. You know, it's interesting, though, is for these reasons, when I I was in graduate school, I did some reading, in social work I was reading about how the United States was the, people were trained to the United States to look to see how to, for race relationships in a country. Mm-hmm. As a leader, like, mm-hmm. let's look to America, to the United States to see how they've done it, which made me laugh at first. It's like, are you kidding me? You're not doing a great job. The truth is that many countries have not started to deal with it, and so we have to take our job as actually role model fairly seriously because people are looking to this country to figure out how to do it, which is a frightening thing. I know.
I don't think it helps with the separation that we have between people either, without saying, you know, in that case, I didn't know. Well, no, you don't know because you don't know anybody or are involved in anyone's life with a different race on them. And I had an odd experience last year when there were three black women at the university where I work invited me to go to hear a speaker. And I was thrilled that they asked me. So here we were in the car with our, and it was an interesting feeling for me to be with three black people and I was the white. And we got to this place, and it was a very large place, and went to buy tickets, and those three were together, and then I came along. And I said, I'd like a ticket next to them. And then this man pulled the tickets away, and he said, are you together? And it was the way he said it. I said, yes, I am with these three people. Oh, and then he just gave me his ticket. And the others heard it too, and I said, you know, that is a very strange feeling for me. And they said, well, it happens all the time. So, you know, you just, it's, unless you are with it, you don't know.
Now, these classes are required for teachers, mm-hmm. are they not, in most states? I know working with preschool, we have in Minnesota, but I don't know if it's all the way up. Through high school, like Ross is, or
but the class when I took it was pretty rote.
Okay, it was very interactive.
There's some very lame classes.
These were really good.
They were, some are good, but some are.
There were two, and but if at home, the teachers are working and helping, and especially with little ones, and you mm-hmm. have all these dolls and so forth that are. Variety of, mm-hmm. but if at home they don't, it's very hard to
book.
Carry out.
Did you have a?
Well, I was going to say that I had a bicycle tour across America a couple of times. In Jasper, Texas, where they dragged a man to death a couple of years ago because he was black, I met with a school teacher who had been teaching there almost 50 years, and this was in the early 80s. So, she was telling me in the most brilliant way I ever heard about how basically racism is taught generationally, mm-hmm. and to unravel that will take generational stuff, because I grew up in a household where you were defined by your skin color and your ethnic group. It's very well explained to me and understood. And so to reverse that, it's a drop in the bucket in a classroom. It's what happens when you go home. Mm-hmm. That's where it's at, and what happens on the streets. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that in this talk of, one of the interesting statistics to me is there's less than 100,000 interracial, you know, black-white marriages a year in this country or something like that. And it's like a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. And in the overall scheme of how many people get married, so it's going to take generations, and we driving while black is now becoming known as a crime, and as a former prosecutor, driving while black, driving while Hispanic were clearly criminal charges in the mm-hmm. county in which I was prosecuted. Mm-hmm. That's why they got the treatment they got.
Yeah, Pam, I know you have to go, but I just wanted to say one other thing. The wailing and the macaw tribes is doing the wailing. And the thing that and maybe this is going to be unpopular because people are very sensitive to animals here, and I am too, I love animals. But what bothers me about that whole thing, maybe the macaw tribes could have picked a better tradition to hang on to, that's true. But the fact that everybody's incensed about this one whale, and nobody's standing up and saying, how can we help you regain some of your traditions? just bothers me terribly. And I've gotten into discussions with people, and they have no perception of what's happened to the Native Americans in this country. So that thing about we didn't have a voice, it so permeates us that we will stand up for a whale before we will stand up for our brother, our sister, you know.
I was going to close. It is time to go, so I'm supposed to. I actually were 5 minutes over. I was just going to close with a story that was shared with me by Janetta Cole, who was she's an African American woman who was the president of Spelman College, and she shares with a story about Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae was a famous black woman, and she said these. Maybe some of you have heard this before, but it's the story of some young black boys who decide to catch this bird, as young boys sometimes will be, you know, brought to do, and we see them with the chipmunks here. But and they're like, we're going to have some fun. So they took this bird, and one boy put it behind his back, and they went up to her and they said, old woman, tell me what to do. Is this bird alive or is it dead? And then they were like, well, if she says it's alive, I'll break its neck and prove to her it was wrong. And if she says it's dead, I'll let it go free. And either way, she'll be wrong. And the old woman just said, it's in your hands. And I'll leave that with you. I think it is all in our hands.
So, thank you. Okay.